Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
With less money and fewer firefighters, departments have to use their people in the smartest and safest ways. So the next time you're speccing an apparatus, think manual and remote control monitors. Why, TFT practically reinvented radio frequency handheld controls for monitors, flowing from 15 up to 2,000 gallons per minute. Since every firefighter counts, so does every purchase. We can help maximize your team's Firestream's performance today. Visit us at www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686.
Welcome to the Apparatus Architects Podcast with Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand. This edition, we're going to talk a little bit about just a rundown of some of the more recent noteworthy events that have gone on that have been apparatus related. Mike's going to take care of that. And I'm going to talk for a little bit about just some things going on within the apparatus industry. A little bit of good news and some that's not so good, but to bring everybody up to date about the recent developments there. We're going to handle a couple of questions that have come in for some of the listeners that have emailed in to us, and we're very thankful for that. And then right after the break, we're going to finish up with a concept that's very near and dear to Mike's and my heart, and it's entitled Protecting Your Assets. Some concepts or things that you can do, much of which is not new, and a lot of it, very frankly, to the listeners, is just common sense, but unfortunately, as you read some of the events of what's going on between customers and relationships with dealers and the apparatus builders, some of these things maybe are not so much in the common sense stream. So having said that, Mike, why don't you lead us into some of the more recent newsworthy events or things that we want to bring our listeners up to date on.
Great. Thanks, Tom. I have a lot of news to get to today. Again, some good, some not so good. Apparatus strikes seem to be on the rise once again. There have been several serious crewless civilian versus fire apparatus crashes of note. One, a woman was injured when she pulled out in front of a responding apparatus in Tucson. The fire apparatus was responding to chest pains. The engine had the green light and was responding with lights and sirens when the woman pulled out against the red light and struck the truck. No one on the engine was injured. Why? Because they all had seatbelts on. And we're going to talk more about civilians and other vehicle striking fire apparatus later on and maybe some proper positioning. Marin County, California, fire captain is critical condition after his fire apparatus struck him and wedged him against another apparatus. He was airlifted to a hospital, to a trauma center. He suffered a broken leg and massive blood loss, but according to officials, he is going to make it. A firefighter in North Carolina was killed in the line of duty when he lost control of his POV while responding. He was a member of the Coldwater Volunteer Fire Department. He ran off the road around a sharp curve, overcorrected, lost control, and flipped. And according to official reports, he was not wearing a seatbelt. An interesting article I found as it relates to seatbelts. A man by the name of Paul McAleer focused on comfort, adjustable seats, and a tilt steering wheel and extra height. He is a self-described, and I quote, fat guy, and he did a study on how body size increases is a direct correlation to the decline of seatbelt use. And, of course, that's an issue near and dear to our heart here, Tom and I, as we work on the new seatbelt program. And just a quick update on that. The body scanning has been completed down in South Texas. Jen is writing up the report, and we should have some initial data available for next month's podcast here on Firehouse.com. Next headline, New Jersey mayor orders the shutdown of a fire station. There were concerns about the volunteer firefighters. There was some serious questions, and residents have actually expressed concerns because a lot of times the fire department does not get out on calls. He said the mayor also said there were issues of liability because of allegations of firefighters drinking on the job and actually having qualified personnel on the trucks. An interesting twist to modern-day liability. A Colorado chief's car was struck twice. He was actually blocking traffic and unbelievable. The second vehicle to strike him in the snow and the ice was a state trooper. All were belted. Nobody was hurt. In New York State, a fire officer has been charged with DUI and an apparatus. He crashed a fire truck into a utility pole following an appearance at a parade. He has been charged, and that's going through the legal system. Again, another problem in the fire service. And just this past week, with much sadness, a firefighter with the Weld County Volunteer Fire Department was going on a medical run. Actually was a professional truck driver and was driving a tandem axle pumper tanker. He lost control, went off the road, overcorrected, flipped the truck over, and was ejected and was killed and left behind two little boys, 9 and 7, and a wife. And our prayers and our hearts go out to those folks out in Colorado as of this taping. The fire department pumper tanker was a custom model, and the pictures that we were able to obtain showed little or no intrusion into the cab. And again, it's just a line-of-duty death that was totally preventable. Had he worn a seatbelt, we wouldn't even be talking about this particular crash. A Texas ambulance collided earlier this month with an 18-wheeler. Only minor injuries in that particular wreck. And just overnight last night, a man steals an ambulance and then strikes two police cruisers before he's arrested in Massachusetts. Again, just another point of securing the rig before you go do anything, because you just never know. And then we always have our kind of newsworthy awards, and again, this month we have a tie. In New Zealand, have you ever heard about the unbelted moronic bonehead who used a fake car seatbelt to fool police so he didn't have to wear a seatbelt? Well, he sure fooled them. The seatbelt faker was killed in a head-on crash. He had refused to wear a seatbelt while driving and had been fined 32 times in the past years for not wearing one. So he decided to fake it, and he ended up losing his life in a head-on crash. And finally, to wrap up the other kind of moronic event, a department standard operating procedure that makes seatbelts optional. Hard to believe in this day and age, but, and I quote, "Seatbelts and or shoulder harnesses are installed in each vehicle an apparatus and are to be used at the discretion of the firefighter and or the officer in charge while responding." Any fire department, any chief, any municipality that takes that stance is just looking to get sued. Tom, we have other industry news today regarding some manufacturers and their troubles. Can you update us on those folks?
Yeah, Mike, after some of those news items, I don't know that we're going to be able to be any more uplifting for the listeners here. And some of this information has been out in the public domain for a while, but we're going to just comment on what's going on and then talk a little bit about some forecasts as Mike and Tom sees them as to what might be coming down the road. I guess by now most all of our listeners are well aware of the woes of the American LaFrance Company, and the fact that they filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy proceedings several weeks ago, that those proceedings are going through the court process, and which will allow the company to reorganize and come back out in some fashion after they determine how the existing creditors, in many cases the creditors include not just the people like the fire pump folks and the engine and transmission folks, but their creditors also include some fire departments that put down some prepayment monies in advance on the contract in exchange for a lowering of the dollar value of the initial bid price. And we'll be talking a little bit about the advantages or disadvantages and things that you need to at least consider if your department is going to do that moving forward. So the tenuousness of American LaFrance really hasn't become a whole lot clearer, other than the fact that it looks like the departments that did have protection of a performance bond will at some point in time, based on American LaFrance's recently put out production schedule, will allow them to see when their vehicle would be produced. So that's item one. Number two, within the last probably 7 to 10 days, it came out in the public domain in some of the newspaper articles out of the Ocala area that the Emergency One fire apparatus, which for many years, I believe since 1979, has been a wholly owned subsidiary of the Federal Signal Corporation, that Emergency One is for sale, and apparently they have several, as it's referred to in the industry, suitors, folks who are interested in buying Emergency One from Federal Signal. So that's yet to be determined who those companies are. Obviously, when you get into that stage of negotiations, where I believe the legal term is due diligence, where the people are evaluating one another's financial records and a whole bunch of other legal documentation, that nothing can be said or stated in terms of who's doing what or what the extent of the negotiations are. But we'll keep our listeners updated as to how that progresses here in the weeks ahead. Certainly somewhat of a turbulent time for the apparatus industry, not unlike what it was like, Mike, between, like, say, 1985 and 1991, 92, when a bunch of well-known manufacturers in that time, including Hahn Fire Apparatus out of Pennsylvania, Maxim Motors out of Massachusetts, the very well-known and renowned Peter Pirsch Company out of Kenosha, Wisconsin, Ward LaFrance or Ward 79, and Young Fire Apparatus, which was up here located in western New York, among many others, a bunch of name companies that all went out of business for different reasons, but ultimately had to do with financial strength and or backing of the company. So once again, we find ourselves in 2008, barely into the third month, and it's once again a very turbulent time. Also, it's come to light that, as most of our listeners know, Mike and I had talked quite a bit during 2007 about the engine emission impact on what that was going to be doing to diesel engine packaging in our custom cabbed apparatus in particular, and the next round of engine emission requirements stipulated by the EPA from the federal government is due to take effect in 2010, which really is not all that far away when you start thinking about the lead time necessary to work and design a piece of apparatus, and you sign a contract, and that's going to take at least typically 8 to 10, maybe 12 months to procure the unit, and that means the manufacturer has to have all those major components in the purchasing pipeline before they go to lay down the chassis frame rails if it's a custom unit. Well, Detroit Diesel, within the last several weeks or since our last podcast was aired, has announced that in 2010 they are no longer going to support the fire service or emergency services vocation with their engines. And there's been a lot of talk about it. If you look at some of the different comments on the websites, it's very interesting to me from folks that say, that, oh, my God, they're going to rethink their decision. It's a wrong decision. They're going to miss us. I guess it's time to maybe take off our helmets for a second and sit down and have a reality check. And this not only impacts Detroit Diesel's decision, but this impacts a lot of the things that we in the fire service have expectations from with respect to when we buy a piece of motorized fire apparatus. So having said that,
it was the same, Tom, with Mack trucks, right? I remember people saying that they would definitely not go out of business and that they had to rethink this decision. They were making a terrible mistake. Don't you remember that?
Yeah, there were probably a multitude of reasons why Mack trucks stopped producing one of the most noteworthy and famous cabs and chassis, at least of the generation of the 70s and 80s, was the venerable Mack CF cab forward chassis. That ultimately they stopped producing that because when engine designs, again, based on some EPA requirements back in the 91 to 92 time frame, was going to require Mack to re-engineer that cab to accept the physical size of the new engine and the attendant cooling packages, they determined there just wasn't enough market for them to build that CF cab and chassis, and they stopped building it. Earlier than that, they had stopped building complete fire trucks in total back around 85 or 86, as I recall, and the last Mack CF chassis rolled off the line in 1991. And yeah, a lot of people looked at it, you're right, Mike, and said, oh, they're going to regret that decision and they're going to come back and get back in the business. Well, here's some facts and figures why our fire service that we've come to know and love is not a big attraction to a lot of other major component folks, including Detroit Diesel. So having said that, every year for the last, at least as long as I can recall, certainly at least 8 to 10 years, there is somewhere between 5,000 to 5,500, maybe 5,600 fire trucks purchased in North America every year. That's the United States and Canada. We need to just briefly realize that the United States designed piece of fire apparatus is not used in a lot of places outside of our country here in the States or in Canada. There are some small pockets or markets where U.S. designed fire truck is used in South America, few places in the Middle East and Saudi Arabia, and just a handful of other locales. But you don't see, for example, a New York City designed rear mount ladder running around in Germany or France or Italy or England or Scotland. The apparatus that protects the European nations and most other locales are things that are built within that area. So our market at 55 to 5,600, when you compare that to the number of over-the-road class 6, 7, and 8 trucks that are produced every year in the hundreds of thousands, 5,500 is not a big number. Now let's go one step further. We've had pretty healthy debates in the past between a commercial chassis, be it on a Navistar or a Freightliner or a Kenworth or a PACCAR unit or any one of the big heavy Class 8, the White Western Stars. If we take that body of work, that 5,500 cabs and chassis each year, about 50, sometimes it's a little bit more, 55% of them are commercial chassis, and the balance of them are custom chassis built by all the apparatus builders that we see each year out traveling the show circuit and that we might have in our own fire department. So now we take that 5,500, for example, and halve it. We're saying at best now, maybe 2,500, 2,700 rigs are custom chassis, and of that, at least let's take in the engine market, we have Caterpillar, Cummins, and Detroit Diesel are the three predominant engine suppliers in the custom chassis market. I'm sure the market's not divided up third, 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 evenly, 33% each for those three vendors, but let's assume for the moment that maybe even Detroit Diesel had 50% of the market, and I'm not, Michael and I aren't privy as to what percent of the market they had, but let's even give the benefit of the doubt and said they had 50% of the market. 50% of that 2,750 cabs and chassis means that we're talking a very, very small number of engines that they would potentially be able to sell to the fire and emergency services market. And then that additionally gets divided up where Detroit Diesel's engineering resources have to work with all of the major apparatus builders that build their own cabs and chassis. So not in any particular order, but at the very least, you would have American LaFrance, Pierce, Emergency One, Seagrave, Spartan Motors, HME, and any one of the other, KME, any one of the other folks that make their own cab and chassis. Detroit Diesel engineering resources have to work with the engineering groups and those different cab and chassis builders and fire body builders to be able to engineer that Detroit Diesel package into the chassis. Now, Mike and I, again, are not privy to any information, but I'm kind of guessing and surmising by reading a little bit into this memo that if you look at the expense that Detroit Diesel probably bore to get their 2007 compliant engines into that whole armada, those all those different builders of cabs and chassis, and did that in 2007, and look at how many engines they are selling each year and what their forecast for that expense would be in 2010, they're looking at it and saying it's just simply not a viable financial proposition for them to go do that. Now, as much as Mike and I look at, and I can say this from the bottom of my heart, because I've been blessed with working in the apparatus industry for almost the last 28 years of my life. While we look at the fire apparatus industry as being second only to something so sacred as going to church on Sunday, the bottom line for our listeners are it is intended to be a money-making business. Look at the issues that American LaFrance and Emergency One and a bunch of the other manufacturers have had, Elite Fire Apparatus, which went out of business towards the latter part of last year. there are a bunch of companies out there, to our listeners, that are attempting to make money, and for a whole host of reasons, not all of them necessarily the manufacturer's fault. It's very, very difficult in this industry to consistently build a good product. Just about everybody can do that, because if you didn't build a good product, you wouldn't have any customers out there. But it's very, very difficult to compete in this marketplace with all of the different manufacturers that are out there and consistently make money. But making money becomes very transparent based on how many small little, as we would call them, mom-and-pop fire apparatus builders are there out there today as compared to an apparatus builder that may be physically larger in size and build more units, but those folks are owned by some larger conglomerate or a holding company or someone that has to report the dollar value of that company back to its shareholders, and every 90 days has to declare to their shareholders, we either made money and we're going to give you some money back on your investment, or we haven't made money and you're going to lose some money on your investment. Our apparatus industry has turned upside down almost 360 degrees here in the last 10 or 15 years based on the number of small little, you know, privately held companies versus companies that are owned by these larger conglomerates. And you can think what you want about Detroit Diesel pulling out of the apparatus industry. I, for one, many of the pieces of apparatus I've driven over my career have been powered by Detroit Diesel engine, and they build a fine product. The fact that they're pulling out, I don't think should be taken that they're thumbing their nose at the apparatus industry or the emergency services. I think it's an issue that they're looking at that they can't make money on their product with all of the engineering changes they have to absorb, and then trying to engineer that into umpty-ump different configurations of custom cabs and chassis, as compared to selling that product in an over-the-road truck where it's a Class 8 with a large hood in front of it, and you can have a huge cooling package in there, and you only have to do that once, and you can sell several thousand of those rigs as compared to selling onesies and twosies in our market. So, Mike, that's, to me, just a little snapshot of where we're going. And, again, people, it's very emotional over this. To me, it's a parallel if you purchased a car, you know, or particularly for guys who drive these big pickups. You are very, very loyal to that one brand, be it a General Motors product or a Ford product or some product that, you know, an import that comes into our country. And people are very, very brand loyal with respect to that diesel engine and power plant. And it's unfortunate to see that in the past, at least in the custom world, you had three different choices. It now appears that your choice is going to be down to two. But that's just, to me, a little snapshot of, you look at everything that goes in, all the different components that a fire truck manufacturer has to buy, particularly if they build their own cab and chassis. They're bringing in frame rails. They're purchasing a very expensive engine and transmission, axles. They're building their own cab, typically within the facility. That is more labor intensive than components. But if you look at the major components that go into a cab and chassis before you put the fire body on, the higher percentage of that cost is in some of the fixed components that you're buying. And when you look at all of the overhead and carrying costs that you have to go produce that product, to bring it to market, to engineer it, to get it EP2 tested so it can, the cooling package is certified, to have the cab crash tested so it meets the safety standards, and now with some of the other pending NFPA standards, to me, it's not hard to see, while the perception of the buyers might be that the apparatus industry has got to be making money hands over fist and just literally using a snow shovel to put it in a wheelbarrow to cart it down the road. I can assure you, I wish that were the case. There are some builders that are very successful financially, but again, you go back and look at the snapshot of America LaFrance and E1, and for the moment, take your emotion out whether you like that product or don't like the product. The issue becomes everybody is in this marketplace and doing their very best to try to build a good product and somewhere along the line, make money. If you don't make money, then ladies and gentlemen, it doesn't make any difference whether you're building fire trucks or trying to sell birthday cakes. You can make a great birthday cake, but if every one you sell you're losing money on, chances are the people that underwrite or support your company sooner or later are going to tell Tom's Birthday Cake Emporium, we're not supporting you anymore, and we're going to find another endeavor to get into. So that's some of the background that you see with what's going on in the apparatus industry, and for the next, you know, foreseeable couple of years, with you look at some of the economic indicators of where they think our country is headed, either are going into a recession. In many locales, the budget monies are getting tighter at the local, at the municipal level. In some cases, the types of apparatus that are going to be purchased in certain categories are going to be coming down, and the competition is still out there. Yeah, I unfortunately think the next 18 to 24 to 30 months is going to kind of be a little rough for many folks here in the industry to survive this, call it a downturn or whatever you want, but it's going to be a little bit difficult for people to see their way through clear to the other side of the river and to come out of this successfully.
Well, I think we're looking at two major price increases in the next 2 years as well, right, Tom? We have the NFPA 1901 standard that's going to take effect in 09, and then we have that other round of emission EPA engine standard that's going to take effect in 2010, and we can expect, you know, fairly substantial price increases out of both, correct?
Well, yeah, it's certain that the prices of apparatus, Mike, are going to go up. I haven't heard any good hard numbers yet on what the impact of the next round of 1901 regulations are going to be. All very, very well thought out, all things that need to be included in the apparatus in the safety area, but that's going to, without a doubt, that's going to come at an expense. And certainly, Mike and I can't argue from a safety perspective. Let's just throw a number out there and say, hey, the cost of all these different standard things are going to add another $3,000 to $5,000 to the cost of the rig. At that point, you cannot put a price on safety. You can't put a price on the ability that this is going to increase the safety environment within the cab and in the apparatus to make it safer for the brothers and sisters to operate on. But without a doubt, if you're planning an apparatus purchase between now and 2010, I guess one word of advice would be no one can even project what the attendant cost of 2010 engines are going to be, or the re-engineering that's going to be involved with custom cabs and chassis to make those engines fit. So it would certainly be an appropriate time that you would probably want to buy the rig sooner rather than later. Take that together with, again, some of the economic indicators that are going on in the country right now and the impact of inflation, that historically fire apparatus prices have somewhat paralleled some of those economic indicators and gone up 3.5% to 4% to 4.5% maybe per annum, with the cost of a lot of the goods and componentry that goes into the fire apparatus. The cost of raw material and metal certainly has skyrocketed over the last several years. Not that we want to scare our listeners, but look at the impact of what happens when the cost of a barrel of crude oil varies on a daily basis based on stock market projections and costs, and the impact that has at the price when the next time you go down to fill up at the pump. I think, again, not to scare folks, but the days of fire apparatus prices only going up by 2% or 3% or maybe even 4%, that's probably going to be history as well. Now, 4% doesn't sound like a lot of money until, let's say, you're out buying a custom chassis pumper and the pumper's going to come in at $360,000 to $370,000. You want to buy some equipment with it, and when you get all said and done, the tab for this new rig is going to be $400,000, and you've gone in front of your village or township or municipal officials, the chief or whomever, laid bare his soul, said this is the kind of money we need, the community's encumbered it, it's a budget line item, and you've got $400,000 for your next pumper, and you think, man, I'm sitting here the proverbial fat, dumb, and happy. You wait until this time next year to bid the project, and your friendly fire apparatus salesperson comes back and goes, well, we had a 4% price increase that took effect on January 15th, and since you're bidding the rig, here we are in March, our bid's going to be 4% higher. You just spent $16,000 more for that vehicle and didn't get anything quantifiable in return. You just simply, the price went up. And to that point, Mike, before we get into the questions that you have, you know, a lot of people, again, the perception is that the apparatus manufacturers and some of the salespeople that these guys are just raking in the money. And I guess I'm here to tell you, at least with many of the good brothers that I work with in the apparatus industry, including an incredible number of friends that work for competing companies for myself, that these folks are not making a whole heck of a lot more money, if at all, than they were 8 or 10 years ago. So these folks are not making double-digit profits, particularly at the sales level, when you buy a new piece of apparatus. The overall cost of rigs is going up for all the other aforementioned reasons. You look at some of the components that we now routinely put on our apparatus. 10 or 15 years ago, it was somewhat rare to have a pumper equipped with a foam system. Now somebody says, I want to have a dual agent foam system. That's a great little option, but depending upon what you've chosen, you've spent anywhere from $7,000 to maybe as much as $15,000 to $20,000 additional to put a foam system on there. Not that it's not needed, but it all costs money. Back 8 to 10 years ago, the typical engine company had a small little modest diesel generator in some areas of the country, not just to throw out a name, I mean a Honda or any decent brand 5,000 or 5,500 watt portable, in some cases even gas generator with a small little cable reel and a couple of lights was pretty much standard. Now the majority of engine companies are built and delivered with 6, 10 or higher kW output hydraulic generators, in many cases light towers with dual cable reels. Again, all these components are great, but if you put on a 10K hydraulic generator, couple cable reels and a light tower, depending upon make, model, and degree of difficulty for the installation, you just spent somewhere between $25,000 to $35,000 additional. Again, not that it's not needed and could be justifiable, but between foam systems and light towers and some of the 120-volt appliances that we're putting on rigs now, you can easily have added $50,000 of cost to the rig. It hasn't done anything to put out more water, all right, or to do anything else other than to add those options to the rigs. So the day of the, you know, trying to find the bargain basement $300,000 Class A pumper in a lot of parts is just simply gone. And the perception of the people buying these is that, okay, if I put a $50,000 light tower generator package and a whole bunch of other electrical things on there, that dealer just made another $10,000 in profit because it cost me $50,000 to put it on there. And I guess I'm here to tell you that's not really the case. You might not want to believe it, but sometimes you're getting sticker shock with the cost of apparatus today when you start looking at Michael in your area. You know, a tower ladder today, if you're going to buy a tower ladder of any description and put a pump and a tank on it, not that that's Mike's and my favorite vehicle, you better have $900,000 to $950,000 burning a hole in your pocket, because that's the beginning price of admission. And we've already heard of numerous places buying the $1 million fire truck, and you look at it and you say, nothing special, it just replaced the last ladder truck we bought, and yet the thing was $1 million. So you couple that in together with some of the other news out there, and again, we're not trying to paint a dark, bleak picture, but I think if you're going to spend your money, as we're going to talk about after the break, you need to spend it wisely and have some things in your specs that will be there to protect you. And we're not talking about the technical language of describing how the lap door was supposed to be formed with the Cleveland hardware at the top. We're talking about some nuts and bolts boilerplate stuff to keep you out of trouble. So, Mike, that's life as Tom sees it, and it's I think it's going to be a little bit difficult and a little rocky here for the next couple of years until we get through and see what 2010 brings us with these engines and some other things just kind of rise to the surface.
But I can't agree with you more, Tom, and like we had discussed previously, the idea of manufacturers being able to purchase all of these parts and have 20 or 30 apparatus in varying degrees of completion and having that much money invested before fire departments actually hand over their money and pay for the stuff, I think that has to go away as well. I think the business models for the different manufacturers are just going to have to change. They're just not going to be able to lay that much money out for long periods of time, in some cases maybe up to a year, and not get any money out of the customer. I think that's just foolhardy to believe that in the long term.
Yeah, Mike,
the price of the components continues to go up, and the cost of business continues to go up. I have a couple questions before we head to break. The first one is a chief who's trying to replace a ladder, and his town is willing to replace the truck by bonding, and they're willing to bond for $750,000. The problem is the truck committee was set up to look for a replacement, set their sights on a demonstrator. In many cases, it says here that it may be too much truck for the town, in the opinion of some, and there's been a bit of controversy. Can you speak to that, Tom?
Well, Mike, I guess a couple of things come to mind, not knowing the specifics in terms of what kind of the style of apparatus the department was thinking of buying as compared to what the demonstrator unit has on it. A couple of things, and not that demonstrator rigs can't fit an important bill and maybe fit a niche for your community, but most of the major manufacturers build demo rigs, or what they refer to as stock rigs, for several reasons. Anymore, when we travel to shows, and for example, the Fire Department Instructors Conference upcoming here, you know, at the end of April, it used to be back in the day that a department would get a rig built, and if a manufacturer was going to put on display, for example, six rigs in their booth, you would try to get a customer to let them borrow their delivered and paid for rig back to go put on display in a show. Well, for a whole lot of reasons, that's getting more difficult to do. So that prompts, if the manufacturer wants to show off six rigs, and that means he's got to have six demos, or at least some demos available to take to the show to put on display, particularly in the area of aerial apparatus. I think Mike has spoken and written extensively about the fact that if your community is in the market, let's make this up, for a new rear mount ladder quint, and it's replacing a 70s vintage midship mount 100-foot ladder, you want to get any of the prospective vendors that you're thinking about or entertaining to supply the unit for you to bring a similar or like rig into your community, drive it around, make sure it fits the firehouse, drive it through the community to see how it operates in the streets, get it set up at some of the downtown or the other target hazards, not the school parking lot, and see how this rig physically operates within your community. Looking at it at a showroom floor, or having a prospective vendor bring in a demo unit, set the maxi brake, throw down the wheel chocks, and have it sit on the ramp of the firehouse, that's great for everybody to gawk at, but that doesn't do anything to prove that operationally it's going to do what you need to do. If you go out to go buy a car, I'll bet there is very few of our listeners, even if you're buying the exact same make and model that you're coming out of and just going to a newer version, you go into the auto showroom, go, I want that, give it to me in the metallic blue with the pinstripes and put the aluminum wheels on it, and it's sold. What do? We take a test drive in something. You still want to do that same thing with the apparatus. So demo units do have a distinct purpose within the industry. However, if you're in the market, particularly for an aerial ladder, and it's something that is going to be in your community for 15 or 20 years, unless your existing truck is broken, been deadlined because of a non-destructive testing of the aerial device and can no longer be functional, you've blown the engine and you don't want to put any more money into it, buying a demo unit, while it might seem attractive because you can get it right away, immediately, and like fulfill that need, if the demo unit doesn't have the majority of the components on there that you were interested in buying, that maybe then is not a good deal, even if it is at an attractive price. Most of the vendors tried, this is not anything that you had to go to the Harvard Business School to figure out, they go with the old 80-20 rule. They look at it and say, what are the components that 75 to 80% of our customers, for example, would normally put on this rear mount quint? So we're going to put a 1,500 GPM single-stage pump. We're going to put a 500-gallon water tank on there. It's got a 105-foot, four-section steel rear aerial. It's got the normal compartmentation. We threw on some whizzy LED lights, and it probably has, Mike, not surprisingly, the NFPA complement of ground ladders on a quint, which would be 85 feet. Well, if you're replacing that 1970s vintage midship ladder that maybe had 165 or 169 or 188 under feet of ground ladders, that 85 feet of ground ladders is maybe not what your community needs. And that, to me, if I was the person ultimately making the decision, that would be the showstopper. if the rig is white over red, but it's not the right shade of red for my community, I could really care less, because that doesn't do anything to put out a fire. But if I only wanted a smaller water tank in exchange for more compartmentation and more ground ladders might save some of my personnel, or we might be able to throw more ladders or maybe save a civilian. That would be a heck of a lot more important to me than what the brand of the warning lights were, or, you know, what kind of seats it had inside the cab. So I think that you need to just carefully look at, and if you hadn't yet determined what the major components and what the major features of the rig that you wanted, we just find a lot of times the demo unit, people kind of get, and we don't mean to say this in a negative term, but kind of like sucked in, the fact that it's there, it's sitting there, geez, we don't have to write a spec, just buy this for us and the problem goes away. And it's kind of like, I have a need, fix it for me right away. That may or may not be the right thing to do. Again, without knowing all the details on the kind of rig the people were looking at and how this rig fits in, that may or may not be the right thing for them to do.
Right. Well, we are firefighters, and one of the kind of people, from a psychologist's point of view, that we attract are people that are in need of instant gratification. You go, you put a fire out, you get gratified, you go to a pin job, you unpin somebody, you get gratified, and, you know, this kind of plays to that when you have this carrot in front of the rabbit, so to speak, and you have this built rig, and the problem that you solve today may be a huge problem that you create at the end of the day, having to have keep this rig for 20 or 25 years and not having those components that you need to have for your jurisdiction. And last, before we go to break here, I got several inquiries off of the last EVOC column that we wrote for Firehouse Magazine. And one of the things that I mentioned in there is that there is a motorsports place that actually trains firefighters and police officers on how to drive 4x4s, which are becoming prevalent in police departments and fire departments around the country. And I was remiss, I did not put that name and address in the article, and it's Leonard Motorsports, Kevin H. Leonard, and his address is 14 Nord Lane, N-O-O-R-D Lane, in Boston, Lake, New York, B-A-L-L-S-T-O-N, Lake, New York, 12019, and you can get a hold of them, and they are the only school in New York and the only one that I'm aware of that actually does suburban Tahoe type training for emergency services, and you can get a hold of those folks for that kind of training. This is the Apparatus Architects with Tom Shannon, Mike Wilbur at firehouse.com radio. We want to take a minute to thank our sponsors, Task Force Tips, and also remember, if you have a question for Tom and Mike, you can email that question into firehouse.com. We're going to take a short break here, and we'll come back and talk about protecting your assets.
Radio at firehouse.com.
Help me out here. TFT has the industry's broadest line of fire suppression equipment, yet everyone thinks we're just nozzles. Sure, we've got all the fixed, selectable, and automatic handheld nozzles you'd ever want, but we also have great foam injection and application equipment, amazing manual and remote control monitors, high-flowing intake valves, and leak-proof suction hose. So if you're specking a new apparatus, go to www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686. TFT makes over 2,300 products. We're not just nozzles anymore.
All right. Welcome back to the Apparatus Architects podcast for this month with Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, your benevolent hosts. And we're now going to come back and talk a little bit about what you can do to protect your community and your department's assets. All right. And with that, we're not talking about the, you know, how to put your money in a longer-term CD. We're talking about if you are in the market for a new piece of apparatus and you are being lured to, for example, you know, put some money up front or work with the vendor that, you know, seems to be on the up and up, but you don't really know a whole lot about them, some things you can do to kind of cover the bases and make sure that if you hit the home run that you touch the other three bases as you go around. So with that, first thing I think we want to do, with respect to some of our earlier commentary about some of the, you know, long-term name companies in the industry, American LaFrance and Emergency One recently, that have undergone some different degrees of financial difficulties and different company reorganizations. One of the things you can do, and this might not be the thing that, you know, you're going to be able to get this document and throw it in front of the fire chief or yourself and maybe make heads or tails of it. You might want to have to pull in a financial advisor or the person who is the typically maybe the treasurer, or if you have a legal counsel that represents your department or your community, they can take you through this. You probably want to ask for a Dun and Bradstreet rating on the company that you're considering. Right? That is a very detailed financial document that takes you through, and you can analyze to see the financial stability of the company. Now, there have been several instances over the course of the last year that we've heard, particularly with companies that went completely out of the business, like New Lexington Fire Apparatus in western Pennsylvania, Elite Fire Apparatus that was located up in Wisconsin, where people had entered into a contract with these companies and then ended up, company goes out of business, they have no fire truck. Well, that might be painful, but I guess not that I'm a big proponent of this, of the NBA basketball sport, but it's kind of like no harm, no foul. In other words, you didn't kill the guy, so we're not going to blow the whistle, put you on a foul line. You didn't put any money out, so the only thing you're really out is your time and maybe, you know, some of your community's goodwill, and they want to know where this fire truck is that you signed a contract for 8 months ago and was supposed to be there in 7 months, and now there's no hope of getting it. If you decided to put down a deposit or a prepayment or something, we're going to talk about that shortly, of things that you can do to make sure that that happens. So, Mike, when somebody asks for a Dun & Bradstreet rating from an apparatus builder, what kind of reaction do you think you're going to get from the salesperson when you say, you know, hey, you look nice, I love your shirt, logo looks great, you showed up in a nice clean car, you got very fancy printed literature, you're throwing blueprints down in front of me, you know, not too concerned about you, the dealer, right now, but I'm concerned about the company you're representing. What kind of feedback do you think you're going to get when you ask them for that Dun & Bradstreet rating?
Well, I think one thing, Tom, you're going to put the salesman on notice that you're serious about your work as an apparatus committee or a committee chair. Also, by gaining this report, you are protecting yourself and the fire department and the truck committee should things go awry. And somebody said, well, did you look into this company and see what their financial prospectus was? And you say, well, yeah, we got it done in Bradstreet, and it seemed fine at the time that we started to do business with them and even entered into contract. You've kind of protected yourself and the fire department by taking that stance. Some people that we had done some work for actually requested Dun & Bradstreet from one of the aforementioned manufacturers that you had talked about before, and the dealership did not provide one. So right away, that put a red flag in the air for those folks and said, well, wait a minute, maybe we need to take a time out. And all the things that we're going to discuss in the next few minutes here have been brought to the forefront by fire departments who have not taken some of these steps and have offered monies to individual manufacturers or dealerships and have lost their money. So, really an important part of the show that we're going over now.
Yeah, and that's absolutely right, Mike. I mean, you have to look at the company that you're buying, the person that's actually going to be bending the metal and painting your fire truck. Additionally, it's really important for you to look at the local dealership. Some of these smaller regional builders don't have much of a dealer or distribution channel, and you may be in a position where you're dealing directly with somebody from the factory, some inside sales coordinator or sales engineering person. He may be your direct contact with the manufacturer, and you don't have some local representative. That can be both a help and a hindrance depending upon where you are geographically with respect to the builder. Most of the larger builders have a pretty widely and well-established and trained dealer network that has geographic territories that cover your area, and you may be buying the fire truck actually through them. It's being built someplace else, but they're acting as the sales agent for the sale of the vehicle. You want to look at the background, the established reputation, and kind of like the resume, so to speak, of that dealership as well, because he's going to be your principal contact throughout the sales process. is going to be your principal contact throughout the building process. And after your unit gets delivered, most importantly, that person is going to be responsible for service and warranty. So where fire apparatus typically has a one-year parts and labor warranty, you'd hope that it covers the entire vehicle, but sometimes there's exclusions to that. Folks can buy extended warranties on either the entire apparatus or certain components on the apparatus. The capabilities of your local sales organization is vitally important to the viability of keeping that apparatus up and operational in your community. For example, this might be extreme, but maybe that local service agency formerly did a lot of work with ambulances, and they just recently picked up a fire apparatus line. And while they have a well-established and recognized reputation for servicing ambulances, when it comes time to servicing, if you've bought that we were talking about earlier, let's take the 100-foot rear mount Quint, that's another completely different animal. And while he may have a building big enough to put it in, some cases maybe even he doesn't, all right, you want to check out the background, the ability, the history, financial strength, and the resume of that local dealership, because he is your first line of defense with respect to resolving issues, whether they're contract terminology or things with respect to after post-delivery issues to service and warranty issues. And understand, as Mike kind of alluded to, we in the fire service, in many cases, we are our own worst enemy with respect to our expectations as to how things are going to be taken care of in the service and warranty area, and whether if there's some defect that we perceive to be a defect on the apparatus, whether it is perceived based on the manufacturer's criteria or interpretation of that criteria, whether it is a service issue, which means we'll be happy to fix it, but you, Mr. Fire Chief, are going to have to pay for that repair, as compared to a warranty issue where the expectation is that it's not going to cost us a dime, other than the pain and suffering to bring the rig and drop it off, switch out into a reserve unit, and operationally be without that rig for some period of time until the warranty work is consummated. And again, if you're buying your fire truck from some manufacturer who has recently gone into the business, maybe he built elliptical or wet side tankers as a product line with small little PTO driven pumps, and now he's decided he's going to start building Class A pumpers, and the next thing that comes, he decides he's going to start building rescue pumpers, and then 2 years after that, he's partnered with some aerial ladder builder and he's now building Quints. If you're buying the first 1, 2, 3, 4 half dozen of these things, you better, as a buyer, be expecting that you're going to have some issues. Don't go into the purchase blind thinking, I'm buying the perfect vehicle. Chances are you're going to have problems, and that's why you have a warranty. That's why the guy needs to have service capabilities that he can service the entire fire truck. Sans if diesel engine or automatic transmission, you're going to be going to one of those vendors to get that work consummated. So you need to do a little bit of due diligence on your own part to check out the capabilities of your local sales organization, because the service after the sale, I can assure you, will be much more important than how many times he took you to dinner when you went out on your inspection trip or your engineering conference. You know, that stuff is long forgotten. If you've had a bad experience or you've had a rig that has some problems, you're going to be much more interested in what that guy can do and how good his service technician or his shop mechanics are to fix your fire truck than you were as to, you know, he bought you the 42-ounce porterhouse steak when you were there for your final inspection. That's done, long, and gone. So a couple of other things to wrap up here of things you can do that you absolutely want to make sure you put in your bid specifications in the boilerplate, in the upfront section before you get into the description of the frame and the front bumper extension and the engine and the transmission. You want to make sure these things are in the spec. Number one, a bid bond. Bid bond should not cost the bidding company any money if they're a reputable organization, and that bid bond ensures that should your fire department decide to enter into a contract with that company, they will honor the bid price that they've supplied at the time of the bid. If they don't, the bid bond is typically worth 5 or 10% of the face value of the bid, and it's pretty rare but it happens occasionally. You hear about somebody that made a mathematical error. They bid the fire truck, but they forgot to include the loose equipment and the $35,000 worth of radios and everything that were in there, and the bid should have been $585,000, not $515,000. He wrote down the wrong number. Well, that's his fault. He's going to have to eat that. The bid bond protects you in that regard. More important is the performance bond. The performance bond ensures that if your community enters into a contract with that manufacturer, that they will duly supply the unit in accordance with the bid specifications that they've supplied within the period of time or reasonable period of time so stated in the bid. Now, the performance bond is vitally important if your community is in a cash crunch, and there's not too many of us that aren't in that situation. Let's say you're buying a rescue pumper, and you were buying it with a complete set of hydraulic rescue tools, and this whole thing came in at $585,000 net to you. Your community, you had kind of had the railways greased up that you thought, you know, the rig was going to be about $540,000. So the night that they open the bid, you see the mayor, you're about ready to call the paramedics and grab the AED because the mayor just had a heart attack because you're $45,000 over the amount of money that the community had allocated. There may be an opportunity for you, however, to lower that price of the vehicle, as Mike had alluded to earlier, by making some degree of a prepayment, all right, on the vehicle so that you're putting money down up front. And for in exchange for that, the manufacturer is going to give you a discount because now he's working off of your money for the period of the contract or some of that money's as compared to having to work off his own bank and floating his own internal floor planning on those components. And in exchange for that, they're going to lower the price by $21,000, for example, if you made a 50% prepay there. Well, if that were the case, that might be something that the community would want to take advantage of. However, at the very least, you want to make sure that you have a performance bond that ensures or guarantees that now that you've given them some money, if something does happen to this company unforeseen during the construction period, you have some resolution to go back on the company, the fact that you have the performance bond and that you made some prepayments. There was a community down in southern New York that entered into a contract with a manufacturer, paid 75% of the amount of monies up front the night they signed a contract, over $320,000, did not have a performance bond, didn't require any kind of letter of credit or anything else from the company. Company goes out of business. Now, not only is this community not going to get their fire truck, they've sent the check for $320,000 plus, and they have no recourse to go back to go get it. I mean, that's just plain out foolish, folks. And you would think today in 2007 or 2008 or upcoming in 09 or 10, we would be smarter. It'd be like me giving a check to Brother Wilbur, as much as we're together on a lot of things, and just say, Mike, I'm giving you $150,000, and at some point you can build something for me, without getting any kind of assurance other than having the contract, which if the company goes out of business and Wilbur Fire Apparatus decides because they owe a lot of people money and it's cheaper to go out of business than it is to pay everybody off, I send them $150,000 and have absolutely nothing to show for it. So performance bonds, absolutely mandatory that you have on any contract, but certainly where monies are going to exchange hands. If you're buying a commercial chassis fire truck and you're going to opt to pay for the chassis, then you ought to insist that the title be transferred over to the fire department or the community or the municipality when you make that payment. So if something again does happen, you've got ownership, you've got title to something. Right, the folks that made some prepayments down to the New Lexington Fire Apparatus Company back several years ago made chassis payments. New Lexington, unfortunately, never took that money to go pay the chassis vendor. So when they went out of business, these small little volunteer companies thought they owned the cab and chassis, only to find out when they called, you know, the different chassis vendors and say, hey, I want to come and pick up my chassis because I own it. The guy goes, no, you don't own it. You know, you may have paid for it, but the monies were never, in turn, going over to the chassis supplier, and there's nothing to show for it. So those kinds
of things.
What
about custom chassis, Tom, other than, say, the HMEs or the Spartans that would go to other vendors? Suppose I bought, just for instance, a Pierce or an E1 or a KME or a Seagrave or an American LaFrance chassis and a product, and the chassis was completed, and I'm going to prepay the chassis. Is there any way that I can get title to that? And then what happens if I get title to it and the body ends up being crappy?
Well, in most cases, Mike, on a custom chassis, you're not going to get title to the chassis because no matter who built it, at least the companies that I'm aware of, there is a title or an MSO for the completed vehicle. It's unlike if you bought it on somebody else's chassis, whether it's a customer commercial, where you buy the chassis as an outside component and then that vendor brings it in. Now there's a separate title to that. But if you're buying, for example, a Pierce or E1 or American LaFrance, you know, Seagrave, whomever, there's not a separate title or MSO for the chassis as a standalone item. There's one for the completed vehicle. So in that case, you know, again, I'm not a lawyer here. The best resolution you would have there is you're going to want to make sure that you have the performance bond, or maybe at least have some type of letter pass hand saying that these components, for example, on a cabin chassis, at least you would have a chassis serial number, an engine and a transmission, axle serial numbers. You might want to bounce that off the person you're buying the rig from and say, if we're going to make a chassis payment, all right, but you're not going to give me title, can I at least get a letter indicating here are the major components and here are the serial numbers that I own all that stuff because I've paid for it? That's probably the best you're going to do there. But again, different states work in different ways, as do manufacturers, Mike, but those that I'm familiar with, there's not a separate title or MSO, like on, for example, on American LaFrance, there's not a title for the chassis and then a separate one for the whole vehicle completed. It's one that covers the whole thing. So it's not like in our state of New York, I think it's called the MV50, it's not like you're going to be able to get that turned over to you if it's a custom cabin chassis. You certainly could if it's a commercial cabin chassis. Or if you're paying for that outright, you want to ensure that that's the case. So if you get those two bonding things in place, then to finish up here, other things that you can do. If you are working with manufacturers or dealerships that you are unfamiliar with, they're nice people, they're located in your town or your county or an hour away, but you're just not familiar with them, the night that you meet with them, in addition to having your little wish list of the things that you want to have on the vehicle, it might be a little intimidating for the folks, but this is a Mike and Tom idea. This is something, you heard this here first, folks, right? Have a little questionnaire that you lay down in front of the person and say, hey, you don't need to fill this out tonight or tomorrow, but within the next 7 to 10 days, we'd like to have this back. And the questionnaire can be such as like, you know, what is this fellow's building or facility like? If he's from 90 minutes away, you might not even know what his building looks like, all right? How many people does he employ? How many, if he has a sales and service organization, how many full-time salespeople does he have? How many EVT certified technicians does he have to work on the apparatus? And just ask him, say, hey, you know, if he doesn't introduce and bring that information to the table and opens up his presentation by, here's the brand of paint we use on the fire truck, that's great, but on most specs, paint's on page 98. I want to learn something about who you are and what your company is before I worry about that you're going to paint the fire truck and it's got a 10-year paint warranty that you're probably not going to tell me it's prorated anyway, but sidebar, okay? So lay down a little questionnaire in front of the guy and just say, hey, fill this out. You know, we just like to know a little bit more. You know, if you got some digital photos, if you're telling me you got 4 trucks on the road, we can see some photos of what these things look like and what they stock. You know, I don't want them showing up to my firehouse and the guy's got, you know, crescent wrench, a ball peen hammer, and a package of 1156 bulbs. You know, that doesn't help me if the rig is stuck and the fork in the transfer case is screwed up and the thing's stuck somewhere between road to pump and I can't go anywhere. You know, those are the kind of things you want to know, because that stuff doesn't happen at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a sunny day. It happens at 2 o'clock in the morning when it's snowing and sleeting and the rig is stuck somewhere and you've never thought about where the heck am I going to tow my 48,000-pound fire truck to try to get it back to the base. So that's one thing. And then taking that one step further, you very frequently, folks, will see this in a large city fire department spec, have a detailed bid questionnaire that goes in your bid package that can ask some of those same questions in terms of the service capabilities, what the dealership, how far away he is, exactly detailing what his facilities are. And then you can also incorporate the technical questionnaire of the major components that you've identified that you want on that fire truck. Say, okay, we've asked for this engine and this transmission. What engine and what transmission are you bidding? You certainly want to have a separate page where the vendor is going to list any exceptions or clarifications. An exception being, let's suppose you've asked for unit because of the duty cycle in your fire department, you want to have two auxiliary braking systems. You want to have not only a Jacobs engine brake, let's just throw that out there, you want to have that combined with an output retarder on the automatic transmission. If the vendor, for whatever reason, cannot supply both of those, that's an exception. And you want them to detail on that page why he can't provide it and what he's offering in exchange for that. That differentiates itself, and it's a very minor point, but it's extremely important because there's darn few bids that Mike and I see anymore that even address this, a clarification. Clarification would be if the Tom Shand Fire Apparatus Company is supplying the Michael K. Wilbur Fire Department, and the Wilbur Fire Department has specified a certain brand, make, and model of light bar to go on his cab roof. But unfortunately, Mike was looking at a catalog that was a year old, and that model number has changed. So it's now not 72 inches long, and it doesn't have six lights in it. It's now 68 inches long, and it's only got five lights in it. That's a clarification. I'm still supplying the same make and the current model, but it's different than what he asked for. So the day when Mike Wilbur comes to inspect the fire truck, he doesn't pull out his tape measure and goes, Tom, what's the problem here? We asked for the 72-inch light bar, and this is only 68, so I got short 4 inches of light bar, and I'm missing one rotator in there. I want my 72-inch light bar. Unless I took clarification to that to make them understand the model has changed, that's like too late in the process for that. So these are some base things we'll be talking and writing about in future columns and talking about in our future podcasts. But see, these are some of the small little idiosyncrasies of buying the fire truck that unless you cover all of the bases, you many times, and as for those, my little baseball analogy, you occasionally during the course of the year see the guy that hit the long ball out to the outfield, it didn't go out of the park, and it's a stand-up triple, and you'll see the umpire back on second base pointing to the base to indicate you cheated here, you never touched second base. Well, it's great that you're on third and you got the triple, but you didn't touch the other bases as you went around. So these are some of the things that can either help you tremendously or create an absolute nightmare for whoever is having to administer the fire truck purchase. So, Mike, there's some things that departments can do to help themselves. Any parting thoughts or things that you might want to add to that?
Well, no, Tom, I think you just gave some great advice, and it's particularly important because it comes from an industry insider who really understands the business of specing, buying, and purchasing fire trucks. And all of our listeners really need to take heed because although the stories are varied, the stories are also many of departments that have lost some or all of their monies in fire truck purchases. And this has been going on for some time now. And the steps that you outline in the second half of the show here are advanced, prudent steps in which you can take in order to protect your assets.
I just want to finish up by, Mike and Tom, the apparatus architects, will be appearing live and in person and walking around and looking at some exhibits and doing some other things at some upcoming shows that we just wanted from planning purposes. The Fire Department Instructors Conference in Indianapolis, which commences on April 7th and goes through April 12th, will be out there. The Harrisburg Fire Expo in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, always a great time down there, will be from May 16, 17, and 18. And then one of the absolute best events of the year that we both of us look very much forward to, the Firehouse Expo in Baltimore, Maryland. It's home for many, many years, commencing on July 21st on a Monday with the hands-on program and going through Saturday the 26th. So those events are things where you can catch us live. And we would, again, anyone that has questions or would like to have things answered, please send them into us, and we'll be happy to address them on the air. So, Mike, any parting thoughts?
No, Tom, look forward to seeing you and all of our friends out in Indianapolis for that show in April and getting there. It's a great show as it's where the manufacturers tend to showcase some of their new 2008 ideas. So always a good time out there. Look forward to seeing you.
All right, so for Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand, the apparatus architects, we'd like to thank you very much to all our fine listeners for for catching today's program. I ask you to please stay safe, and we look forward to seeing you out on the road here in a very short time. Take care for now.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.